Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI urges priests and educators to have a deep understanding of their spiritual role in the formation of young people. The United Nations has designated 2012 as the International Year of Sustainable Energy for All. We discover what this means and why it's important. As we prepare to enter the annual week of prayer for Christian unity, we hear all about its history, its aims, and the changes it has brought about in the past years. And film critic Peter Malone tells us about a beautiful film about the horror of war and the power of love. Pope Benedict XVI on Sunday prayed that all educators, but especially priests and parents, should have a deep understanding of the importance of their spiritual role in helping young people, not only to grow and thrive, but to respond to the call of God. As Chris Wells reports, the Pope was addressing the pilgrims and visitors gathered in St. Peter's Square for the Angelus prayer.
The Holy Father reflected on the readings for the second Sunday in Ordinary Time, focusing on the theme of vocation.
Cari fratelli e sorelle,
he spoke about the call of the prophet Samuel in the first reading and the call of the first disciples of Jesus in the Gospel. Both of these stories, he said, emphasize the person who plays the role of mediator, helping those who are called to recognize the voice of God and to follow it. With that thought in mind, he emphasized the critical role of a spiritual guide in the journey of faith, and in particular in responding to a religious vocation in the service of God and his people. The Pope recalled that a vocation often comes from the witness and suggestion of a spiritual older brother, often a priest, without forgetting the fundamental role of parents, whose joyful and authentic faith and whose conjugal love show their children that building one's life on the love of God is both beautiful and possible. Finally, the Pope looked ahead to the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity, which begins this Wednesday, January 18th, and continues through to the Feast of the Conversion of St. Paul on January 25th. He called on the faithful to join together to pray to God for the gift of full unity amongst all the disciples of Christ. As he concluded his Angelus address, the Holy Father greeted pilgrims from around the world, including English-speaking pilgrims and visitors, and offered them his blessing.
I offer a warm welcome to the English-speaking pilgrims and visitors present this Angelus prayer. I wish all of you a good Sunday. May God bless you.
Thanks there to Chris Wells for that report. Last week saw Pope Benedict XVI addressing diplomats and ambassadors to the Vatican during his annual State of the World address. It was a somber discourse, but certainly not lacking in hope and with a keen eye for the future. At the end of the discourse, the Pope sounded hopeful and positive as he urged respect for creation. He mentioned climate change and environmental protection and looked ahead to the Rio Conference on Sustainable Development, witnessing his forceful stance as regards the protection of creation and the need to invest in environmental concerns. His discourse came at the start of 2012, the year the United Nations has designated as the International Year of Sustainable Energy for All. But exactly what does that mean? To find out, I spoke to Dr. Peter Pavlovich, Study Secretary of Church and Society Commission and Secretary of the European Christian Environmental Network, or ECEN, an organisation which is closely linked to the Conference of European Churches. First of all, I asked Dr. Pavlovich, what does ECEN do?
Basically, what we are in charge is to be in monitoring of European policies. In this regard, with special attention to the environment and energy. But of course, our main stakeholders are our churches in Europe. So we work in coordination and cooperation with a number of churches over the continent, and we try to develop some joint activities with them.
Is it an ecumenical venture?
Exactly. Conference of European Churches gathers 120 churches from all over Europe, from all corners of continents, north, south, east and west. and European Christian Environment Network is closely linked with Conference of European Churches. It means we have members, friends, and colleagues from almost all European countries, and we work very closely together. What is also important to note that it is ecumenical network. We have colleagues from all churches and denominations, mainline churches in the European continent, Protestant churches, Orthodox churches, and we have also friends and colleagues in Roman Catholic Church.
You are an environmental network, so who better to ask about this 2012, which has been designated the International Year for Sustainable Energy for All. Can you tell me what this means and why it's important?
This has several consequences. First of all, energy is something what all of us very much need, whether we are aware or not aware of that. And the simple fact is that consumption of energy is increasing. It is very much linked to climate change and the problem with the environment. And the energy use is ground source of all problems that we have with the environment and climate change. So if we want, as a people, as humanity, as those who are concerned, if we want to address the climate change, it is not possible without taking into concerns what is happening in our energy consumption. Simple fact is that more than 85% of our energy consumption is produced by fossil sources, which enormously contributes to climate change. The other thing, and this is in particular important for our perspective from a Christian point of view, it is a use of energy. We very much not only use, but very often misuse energy. And here is what we would like to address as well.
Can you tell me how?
Of course, the energy consumption, it is a topic for big consumers, for industry and companies. But it is not possible to detach it from the public awareness, from what we think about energy, and also from use in our homes, in our families, and as individuals. The public climate cannot be changed without change of individual attitude and individual approach. And here we are closing very much to our particular concerns as Christians, and this is value-based character of our approach. So it means if we want to save energy, if we want to do something meaningful in protecting the climate and avert the climate change, we have to change the thinking. We have to be aware what values are important for our life and how do we want to deal with them.
So you're saying that the individual actually does have a responsibility.
This is very very significant part of it, on the level of individual consumption, but also on the level of how do we as individuals and Christians, how do we participate on broader communities and in a society as such, with our voice, with our attentions, with our work, we can influence very much also the public, broader public, much broader than our individuals or small communities. So what I want to say is that there are two levels on which we as Christians can contribute to the developments in society and also in discussing of energy and environmental problems.
I see that your website, the ECEN website, actually has a page dedicated to this International Year for Sustainable Energy for All. Do you have any programs or projects with which you are going to participate in this particular year?
Energy is important concerns for us in ECEN. And in our big meetings, assemblies, which we call usually every 2 years, we discuss energy as well. One of our assemblies, we adopted even call to the Christians and churches to the continent, where we underlined in particularly four elements. First, it is sufficiency, then efficiency, need for renewables, and the planet perspective. So with these four elements, we want to discuss energy also in this year, International Year of Sustainable Energy for All. This is important to mention because in this year, 2012, we will organize once again our assembly and discussion of energy. How we as Christians can contribute to this international year will be a significant part of that assembly.
Four elements, just like the four elements of the planet: earth, water, air, and fire.
we can see the link also in this symbolic level as well, of course.
Dr. Pavlovich, on Monday, the Pope gave his annual address to diplomats, which is seen as a very important address because they take his message back to world leaders. And he did conclude it talking about climate change, environmental protection, and looking ahead to the Rio conference on sustainable development. Tell me, how important is it, do you think, for a moral authority, as is the Pope, to take a stand on environmental protection?
It is very encouraging for us to see that also in that level, in the highest possible level, environmental concern about energy and its use are taking into consideration. So it is encouragement for work of all of us. And on the ecumenical level, it is also signal that we can deepen our cooperation in this particular field, hopefully even to better results than we have been able to achieve in the years before.
Are you hopeful for the future, Dr. Pavlovich?
Certainly, yes. As Christians, the element of hope is a strong element of our belief and also very strongly influencing of our work. Of course, we see all around number of difficulties, number of concerns which we are called to address, and many things we would like to change in the world. But we do it in hope and with hope that the change is possible. And we have a number of elements which can contribute to the change in our hands.
You've been listening to Dr. Peter Pavlovich, Secretary of the European Christian Environmental Network. The theme chosen this year for the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity is "We Will All Be Changed," based on St. Paul's words to the Corinthian Church. It speaks of the temporary nature of our present lives in comparison to what we receive through the victory of Christ through the Paschal Mystery. Now, the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity is certainly a highlight here in the Vatican. It includes a myriad of ecumenical initiatives in between its inauguration on January the 18th and the concluding prayer service on the 25th. What I'm saying is that it's an annual rendezvous that we look forward to year in and year out. But how far does it go back? Who founded it? What's its history? I put these questions to Father Jim Puglisi, a member of the Franciscan Friars of the Atonement and the director of the Ecumenical Centre here in Rome, the Centro Pro Unione. He told me that the week's 100th anniversary was celebrated in 2008 and that in the beginning it had a different name.
It was called the Octave of Chair Unity, and it was founded by Father Paul Watson, who was actually our founder of our religious community, the Franciscan Friars of the Atonement. And it was composed of this eight-day week of prayer that went from the chair of Peter, which was a liturgical feast, because that represented the center of unity, and it ended with the conversion of Paul, which represented mission to the world. And in his mind, obviously, unity and mission went hand in hand.
However, Father Jim told me, there were people who before that celebrated prayer for unity in various traditions.
All the churches, I think, which is important, we sometimes forget this, that all the churches had prayers for unity all the time. And these prayers usually were for unity within the church themselves. What is different at this point in time is that the prayer becomes common prayer, one, and prayer that all can take part in for unity. So it's not just that there be unity within my particular church or congregation or denomination, but there should be unity among all Christians who believe in Christ. So this idea Watson got with another Anglican, Spencer Jones, who wanted to celebrate on the feasts of St. Peter and Paul, and Father Paul felt that it was insufficient to celebrate just one day for unity. And in fact, actually 1 week is insufficient for prayer for unity. It should be the mindset of all Christians. In 1935, another Catholic priest from Lyon, Paul Couturier, when celebrating the Week of Prayer in January, had this idea saying that the intentions thus far were in the what we call the Roman understanding of the Unionist movement, that is, those who separated themselves from the Church of Rome should return. And that was the mindset of this week of prayer up until that point, that the Anglicans return, the Lutherans return, etc. And so he said, well, no, we should pray the prayer of Jesus that he said just before going to his own death in John 17, that they all may be one so that the world may believe, but with the intention that unity should be established the way Christ wishes and in the time that Christ wants. So we begin to see a shift in the intentions for the week of prayer from that which was the unionist movement of those who were separated from the Church of Rome to one which would be called the sanctification of Lutherans, of Anglicans, of Protestants, etc., so that the will of Christ be fulfilled as he prayed for it, when he prayed for it, and by the means that he prayed for it.
This then, Father Jim told me, in 1935 began a transformation of what has been the traditional week of prayer.
Couturier knew that he was not the initiator of this week of prayer because the dates have always remained the same from the 18th to the 25th of January, but that he added something to this that enabled it to be more universal. And in fact, he called it a universal week of prayer for Christian unity. In the 1960s, with the collaboration of the Faith and Order movement of the World Council of Churches, then there was collaboration between the Catholic Church, which was celebrating the week of prayer for Christian unity, and the Faith and Order movement of the World Council of Churches. So we began a joint preparation and elaboration of these texts. The prayers also took on a different slant because they became orientated around biblical themes each year. And they were presented by local groups.
So, Father Jim pointed out, there has been a gradual development. What's more, he told me, in the Northern Hemisphere, the dates always remain the same, while in the Southern Hemisphere, the week is often celebrated between Ascension and Pentecost.
What would you say the focus? You've been talking of a shifting focus throughout the history. What is the focus now, today?
Well, the focus is for Christians to not only pray for the unity of all those who believe, and I think this is a distinction I think we should make, that sometimes we pray for the unity of the church, but we believe that the essential nature of the Church of Christ is one. So we're not really praying for that. We're praying for Christians who are separated from one another. And this becomes the focus, I think, of our prayer now, that churches learn somehow or other that we have to prepare ourselves to be ready to accept this gift of unity when God gives it to us. And that's the understanding that Couturier had. That's the understanding that Paul Watson had, really, when he understood that unity should be gathered around the chair of Peter, not in submission to the chair of Peter. But this unity demands diversity. And so it calls for each church to reflect on how it lives the gospel concretely, and in what ways it can see and verify the same living of the gospel in other Christians. I think this is important because, remember, in the foundation of the church, in the Acts of the Apostles, for example, we had two churches, one which is the Church of the Gentiles, evangelized by Paul and others, and the other Church of the Jews. And you remember the first council took place, the so-called Council of Jerusalem, where they had to decide certain issues. And they made a decision at that point that there should be no burden greater than the gospel requires laid on anyone. And I feel that's something that the churches need to reflect on. Do we place burdens on one another that the gospel doesn't ask us to? That's a very difficult question for each church to ask, because we've become so set in our own ways that we only think that the only way to be church is the way that we are church. Second Vatican Council doesn't accept that. It accepts that there are many manifestations of the one Church of Christ found even outside the confines of the Catholic Church, and these are all works of the Spirit. And so that first church, if you want, the Church of the Jews, the Church of the Gentiles, had to deal with this issue, and the solution was to not ask more than what the gospel asked for. And we know that they had to give up, the Jewish church had to give up several very important things, for example, circumcision, dietary laws, all those things which were a key mark of who it was to be a Jew. But now in Christ, all things were made new. And I think that's what we have to realize, that Christ calls us into himself and that he will make us new. What this united church, this one church, will look like, I can't tell you. It will probably look a little bit like all of our churches, but it means that it's going to be different from all of our churches. And it's something that is a gift that God will give to us. And prayer prepares us to receive and recognize that gift when it's offered, and for us to carpe diem, to seize the opportunity when that gift is offered. And we have to take a risk, and we have to take a step forward. Obviously, we can't, no one, no church can deny the truth that they feel is essential in the gospel. And for Catholics, you know, that's a very important part of our own identity. But we have to realize that there are many ways of expressing that same one truth. And that's the unity and diversity that I think God has made in creation. The preface at Pentecost speaks about the marvelous diversity, but yet the mysterious unity that we have received.
Certainly won't be black and white, but it'll be multifaceted, multicolored.
It's going to be like the coat of Joseph. You're right, the multicolored coat of Joseph. Because God created us in God's image and likeness, which allows us to see that there is great diversity, but the essence of God is one. And that unity, in spite of our diversity, is a true gift. And that's why we have to avoid this concept of uniformity, because uniformity really destroys any kind of diversity and unity, because it almost crushes the other reality. But I think that as Christians, we're called to recognize the great diversity that God has made in all of creation, and we stand back and marvel at that. I think we forget sometimes that we are creatures of God's creation, not the Creator. And if we think we're going to create the unity of Christians, I think we've got a wide awakening to happen to us, because it is really going to be God who does this for us. And it comes when we humbly recognize that we are creatures and not the Creator.
That was Father Jim Puglisi, a member of the Franciscan Friars of the Atonement and the director of the Centro Pro Unione. And now Vatican Radio's film critic Peter Malone talks about a recently released film directed by Steven Spielberg, entitled War Horse. Actually, as Peter explains, the film follows an award-winning play of the same name, based on a book by acclaimed children's writer Michael Morpurgo, and adapted for stage by Nick Stafford. The film, Peter says, is equally worthy of mention.
I think War Horse is a fairly wonderful film. I can hear people, and that's the trouble when you go to review a film, you can hear some of the other reviewers, and they're going to say, oh, Steven Spielberg, he's full of sentiment, often sentimentality, and he's melodramatic. And I'll say to, yes, he is, but I was very moved by this film. I thought it was very well done. I hadn't seen the play on which it was based. I should have, but I didn't. And so I came to the film fairly fresh. But it's a World War I film. And it goes for 2.5 hours, but very well done.
England is at war! We are at war!
I saw some of the scenes, and as usual, the Spielberg films, they're so beautifully filmed, the photography is so incredible, and the horse himself is amazing.
What is it?
It's a horse they found wandering about in no man's land.
What kind of an horse?
A miraculous kind of an horse, be my guess.
Can you tell me a little bit about the story?
Yes, it's it starts before the war begins. In fact, I timed it. It's about 45 minutes we spend on a farm in Devon, where David Thewlis is the landowner, who's fairly harsh, especially on a family where Peter Mullen is the father, Emily Watson the mother, and Jeremy Irvine, who's a young actor but very good in this, they're struggling to pay their debts. And the father is attracted by this fine, you know, almost thoroughbred horse, and pays 30 guineas for it in defiance of the landowner. And his wife is very unhappy. How will they pay? And the young boy says he'll train the horse, and they bond. So anybody who loves, you know, National Velvet, My Friend Flicker, there's plenty of bonding between the teenager and the horse. And a very gripping scene where the horse has to plough a very hard field, and everybody looks on. So it's going in that direction, and suddenly war breaks out. The father decides the horse has to be sold to pay the debts, and the horse goes into the army.
I promise you that I'll look after him. If I can, I'll return him to your care. He's my horse, sir.
So with that, it makes quite a transition, training in England, but then they go over to France, Belgium, and in the action there, there is an extraordinary sequence of a cavalry charge. Spielberg, you know, if you remember seeing Saving Private Ryan, he knows how to immerse his audience in a war situation. And from then on, the horse is captured by the Germans and has a whole lot of experiences throughout the war, with a young man looking after him, and that has a tragic ending, and then a grandfather and a granddaughter look after the horse till the army take the horse back, and it's got to carry cannon up hills and be in the trenches.
Can you imagine flying over a war? And you know you can never look down. You have to look forward, or you'll never get home.
And finally, then, the story is about the war and the trenches. And once again, Spielberg is extraordinary in immersing us in the, I suppose, the squalor and the wet and the damp of the trenches, going over the top, the no man's land. I'm getting enthusiastic now, I realise, telling you all this. But the horse does escape. It gallops through no man's land, entangles itself in fences and barbed wire. An extraordinary scene. I don't know how they did it. But it leads then to, well, we expect the horse and the master to meet again. And they do, but not quite in the circumstances that we might have expected. So the horse is really the focus of the film, and that's the title, War Horse.
It is an honor to ride beside you.
It sounds interesting for people who are interested in history as well.
It does. It made me realize as I watched it that World War One, you know, it's almost 100 years ago, and it seems to be receding into history. And with the, you know, the technology of modern warfare, the trench warfare seems very antiquated. But it is amazing, isn't it, the number of films that have been made about the trenches and the war. I'm thinking even of our Australian film Gallipoli. That hard and harsh warfare in the trenches for those 4 years was certainly one of the significant features of 20th century history.
And yet man doesn't learn, does he? He carries on making war, whether it's in the trenches or otherwise. The tragic reality of war is with us all over the world.
And that's what Spielberg, I think, points out, as he did in Private Ryan. But there's a wonderful scene where a young Englishman from the trenches sees the horse with the wire around it and goes out from the trench against orders and calls out to the Germans in the nearby trench, and one comes out with wire cutters and the two combine to free the horse. And you realise, you know, that peace is possible, and at the level of ordinary people there should be peace. And it's the powers that be, for whatever bad reasons, really often create the wars. So I think Spielberg makes the theme of war and peace very strong.
Thank you, Peter. Well, I'll never forget his Schindler's List, but it sounds like a very interesting film.
Yes, it's beautifully crafted, well worth seeing.
Let every man make himself and his country proud. Be brave. Be brave! Be brave!
Laudetur Jesus Christus.